We do. I have another installment of Brave Space. And just a reminder, that's a platform for honesty and presence, where we invite diverse perspectives on how the university and our society can do the work of becoming a truly welcoming environment, not just on paper, but in practice. This week, we're talking to Avi Noam Pat, who is the Doris and Simon Conover Chair of Judaic Studies and the director of the Center for Judaic Studies and Contemporary Jewish Life here at UConn. Pat is a prolific author and editor, and our wide-ranging conversation includes discussions of a couple books he had co-edited that came out earlier this year, Laughter After, Humor and the Holocaust, and Understanding and Teaching the Holocaust. I did want to talk first a little bit about the book that you co-edited, Laughter After, Humor and the Holocaust. Just broadly, what role does humor play in society's kind of dealing with really horrific things?
My co-editors and I, so David Slukey and Gabriel Finder and myself, gathered together about 15 other collaborators who also are really fascinated by this question of taboo topics. What are you allowed to laugh at? What do societal conventions suggest you should avoid making fun of? And of course, one of those number one questions, are you allowed to laugh about a topic as serious as the Holocaust? I had done some work on Jewish humor among survivors in the immediate aftermath of the war, where there was a lot of evidence of both victims during the Holocaust and survivors in the aftermath of the war who used humor as sometimes a psychological defense mechanism, sometimes a weapon to attack Nazis, sometimes a coping mechanism after the war. We were fascinated by this question of how does humor function today in the memorial landscape of the Holocaust? What are the ways in which both comedians and survivors and descendants of survivors use humor to continue to wrestle with the challenges of Holocaust memory, but also as a weapon to attack perpetrators and Nazis? The timing of when it came out in April of 2020 was exactly when we were starting to grapple with the global pandemic, living through a time of crisis, and a lot of people were thinking about how do you use humor in difficult times as kind of a psychological means of coping with intense stress. And so we had a number of articles that came out in the popular press at the same time that were looking at sort of what can we learn from tragedies of the past to deal with our current struggles.
So to completely shift gears and go into the more serious side, you've been very busy. You also co-edited a book that was recently published, Understanding and Teaching the Holocaust. Now, in this current landscape that we're in, why is really understanding the Holocaust so important?
We argue that it's critically important today, 75 years after the end of the Second World War, to continue to learn the lessons of the Holocaust, but also as we're living through a time where we're seeing the passing of the last eyewitnesses, the survivors are passing away, the liberators who were there are passing away, the veterans who fought in the war are passing away. We have to think about what's our responsibility as historians to make sure that we document, but also to make sure that we teach it really well. There's always contemporary relevance. And I think one of the things that's so important is to delve deeply into the historical context, to understand the factors. For example, there's a chapter in the volume that looks at Hitler and the Nazis' rise to power in Germany in the 1930s, or the ways in which the Nazis used legal or legalistic mechanisms to implement their policy of patterns of discrimination and persecution using the passage of laws. Understanding that context is critically important to understand how what was a democratic state can, under certain circumstances, become completely perverted by certain ideologies. And we have to know how to recognize that. We have to be on guard against it. We have to understand how that can happen. At the same time, we have to understand the patterns of discrimination. We also want to understand from the perspective of the victims themselves. For students to develop the proper levels of empathy, to understand what it's like to experience persecution, to experience discrimination. And if they do that, our big hope is that we can create better citizens of not only our society and of our country, but sort of a globally interconnected world who will take care of one another and do what's necessary to protect those who might be discriminated against or might be vulnerable.
As a professor, what lessons do you hope to impart on your students as it relates to anti-Semitism and bigotry and just discrimination in general?
One of the things that's been amazing to me since I've arrived at UConn, we have incredible faculty spread across various departments who do work in Judaic studies. And then I've really come to appreciate and work closely together with directors of other ethnic and area studies programs. And I think we have really strong basis here at UConn for teaching our students to appreciate the diverse experiences of people from diverse backgrounds, but to also understand the ways in which this can help us create a society that is interconnected, that not only appreciates and celebrates diversity, but that confronts all sorts of systems of racism and discrimination that are already in existence.
That makes total sense. It can't be put in these little buckets, because I was thinking about, of course, the connection with the Black Lives Matter protests that are going on. Racism has obviously just been a huge topic of discussion lately. And just as anti-Black violence is alive and well, so is anti-Semitism. In the introduction of Understanding and Teaching the Holocaust, you mentioned that while you were working on this book, several attacks occurred, including the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, where 11 people were killed, the attacks at a grocery store in New Jersey, and the Rabbi's House in New York in December 2019. So this is all, I mean, to me as a white non-Jewish person, my eyes have been opened a lot to the fact that for a long time we were kind of taught Martin Luther King fixed it and the Holocaust is over. And then we're really being smacked in the face with, no, this is not done, and there's so much more to do. What kinds of things should we be thinking about, and how should we be approaching making it better, I guess?
Yeah. I think one of the things that's become clear over the past few years, and I appreciate this idea that we had this sense that things were going to get better and that we were on this constant course to improving ourselves and improving our country. And I think since 2016, where we saw this sharp reaction against having our first Black president, in the sense that, okay, we were on this march to racial progress and racial justice. And it's really, there's so much interconnection between these anti-Semitic incidents and these racist incidents and the continuation of racial injustice. So, for example, in 2017, when the Unite the Right rally took place in Charlottesville, and you had white nationalists and neo-Nazis marching at the University of Virginia, or marching in Charlottesville against what they perceived to be a campaign or a global Jewish conspiracy to overtake white America, and people marching in the streets with these torches saying Jews will not replace us, and lumping together all of these movements, immigration to America, and Black Lives Matter, and what they saw as the fear of overcoming a white nationalist homeland. All of these things are so interconnected, and we can't separate them out. We have to view them in the ways in which they're connected. I do think that one of the things that becomes clear, and a lot of what motivates my work in Holocaust studies and teaching about the Holocaust, is a sense that, as I alluded to before, we're 75 years after the war, and we see the passing of the last eyewitnesses. And for those who would want to deny this history, Holocaust deniers know that time is on their side. And so we have a responsibility to continue to do that work. I think this work will continue. I don't want to hang my head and say that we're never going to reach a better place, but I think it's going to be a constant level of work that has to continue from one generation to the next. I do have a lot of optimism in the next generation. I think that young people who are being raised in this environment are being heavily influenced by what they're seeing, and I hope will be moved by the cause for racial justice, and moved by the cause for social justice, and moved by the cause to protect our environment. It's not too late for all of these things. And that's why I believe in teaching this. I do have optimism that the next generation can fix the things that those of us who got us to this place haven't quite taken care of yet.
We want to take a look at UConn kind of as a microcosm of the broader society. So what is UConn doing well when it comes to diversity, equity, and inclusion? And what do we need to do better?
This is a huge challenge. And if we think about that conversation of diversity, equity, and inclusion, even that phrasing, I think its heart is in the right place. But one of the things that even these protest movements of this year have demonstrated is that it's not simply enough to create DEI committees or to appoint an administrator who's responsible for sort of overseeing it. You can't just say, oh, well, we have these programs in Judaic studies or Africana studies or El Instituto or Asian American or women's gender and sexuality studies. It has to be embedded deeply throughout the curriculum, throughout the structure of the university. And that is a much harder, longer term fix. We have to provide the level of institutional support that not only promotes our abilities to strengthen these programs, to be able to hire people to be able to do the teaching in these programs and to recruit the students who are interested in these programs, but to do the type of systemic change that is going to embed the thinking that underlies these programs more deeply in all of the different departments across the university as a whole, that is going to take much more work on a structural level and a much deeper investment to oversee that change. And that's not just here at UConn. I mean, that's across the academy.
And finally, we're calling this interview series Brave Space. Who do you admire as a model for bravery?
I have a third book that is coming out next year, and it's called The Jewish Heroes of Warsaw, The Afterlife of the Revolt, and it looks at the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. I've been thinking a lot about heroism, what that means to call someone a hero, bravery. And in the book itself, I write about the ghetto fighters who organized the revolt in Warsaw and the people who survived and were determined to make sure that that story got told. There's a number of people, some of them who are more well-known names, like a Mordechai Nalevich, who was the leader of the revolt, but then people who are less well-known. And those are sort of the models of bravery that I think about. So an example is somebody like a young woman who was a member of the underground resistance movement, whose name was Tosia Altman, who served as a courier, would sneak in and out of the ghettos in occupied Poland with false papers, trying to deliver whatever she could to different ghettos. There's another woman by the name of Tzivia Lubetkin, who was one of the leaders of the revolt. And when the revolt was over, managed to sneak out of the Warsaw ghetto through the sewers of Warsaw for 2 days, crawling through, I can't imagine what kind of filth, and then to be dedicated to tell that story after the war. Those are the types of people that when I think about the types of things that we are going through today or the types of struggles that we identify, I think back to people who lived through that and I say, well, if they could get through that, we can get through this. And then of course, I'll just mention one last sort of model of bravery. A lot of members of my family are in the healthcare profession. I think about the people who are on the front lines today, doing whatever they have to do, even if it means continuing their everyday employment or strapping up and going in to deal with this pandemic. That also is a type of bravery that for those of us who sit at home and have the privilege of being able to teach remotely or via Zoom is something that I greatly admire.